You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman produces. Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network at thelasallenetwork.com. They recently published the five pillars of company culture. You should do these things if you want to retain your best employees. Hi, Tom. What are they?
Well, I think number one is you've got to identify and align. And what we mean by that is not every business model can and should be centered around philanthropy or treating your employees great. You know, everybody's got to decide what their mission is, but you have to identify it, and then you have to make sure that your people are aligned in it and have consistency there. The second one is you have to have connection to team. And are you going to be a team environment? Do people come in? Do they feel connected to one another? And that's a really important thing, that whether they're 25, 35, 45, 55, that people feel a connection to one another that builds a trust. The third one is connection to leadership, which I think is highly underrated. And it's not about having a town hall meeting once a week. It's about feeling that you can ping via email or a text or a Teams message or a call into the vice president group or the senior directors or the C-suite and the CEO and get a response back, and that people are there and they care about you. I think transparency is number four, and it's something that, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to open up your books and say, this is how much we pay for toilet paper, but you've got to be able to say, this is what we're doing as a company. We are profitable. We're doing A, B, and C, and to share that with people. And lastly, John, that I think is arguably the most important because it leads into the first four, is learning, growth, and development, is to be a teaching organization, whether you do it internally or you outsource it, where your employees feel that they are growing and being developed as professionals and as human beings.
I don't know why companies aren't more forward with number four on your list. How are we doing? I think that if we're doing well, employees would celebrate that. Sure, they might ask for a little something, or they might gripe that we had a lousy Christmas party and the company made $87 million this year. But I think if I'm giving you my work life, I would like to know what the dividend is. How's that paying off? And one last observation about all of this, Tom. I think if that's a recipe to retain employees, I think that should be the recipe all along. You know, I mean, whatever the objective is, that's how everybody should be treated, regardless of why you're doing it.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that, John. It's the right way to do it. Now, I would say that, if somebody owns a company, that they have the right to determine how transparent they want to be. And employees have the right to decide whether they want to work at a company for what they disclose. And so it's one of those things that, in an interview, an employee can say, what's the transparency level? Do you guys talk about profitability? And if the answer is no, then employees have a right to not take that job. And if an employer says, we explain this and this, but not, you know, D, E, and F, then that's fine too. And I think what ends up happening is people don't stand with confidence on what they believe because they think everybody's got an angle from both sides. And the answer is, you know, we went through a thing where employees didn't care about whether a company was profitable because all they cared about was, I'm working for Uber, and who cares that it's not making any money because I'm going to get rich one day. And everything kind of got lost over the past, 15 or 20 years, where it became about eyeballs, and it became about clicks, and it became about a value without being profitable. And now, with higher interest rates and companies can't borrow money for free, it's becoming back to normal of saying, what's really important in our lives, in our companies, and in our value systems. And I think that's where we're at now. But to say the company should be that way, John, employees didn't care about it for a long time.
Should employees have to disclose, or should they disclose if they have a side hustle of their own?
Well, if you want transparency, it's a two-way street. And I think that that's really an important thing is you know, I never liked the expression side hustle because it implies that you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. And if you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, you shouldn't be doing it. But if you've got something on the side that doesn't detract from your job and it's something you enjoy doing, then there's no reason that somebody shouldn't do that.
And no reason that somebody should be penalized for it.
Not there should be an understanding. Certain companies will say, we don't want you to have an outside job because that means you're not doing as much as you can here, and that's our corporate philosophy. Okay. You should know that from the get-go, and if you're embarrassed to tell somebody about something or you're afraid to, then you probably shouldn't be doing it.
I make mittens for bunny rabbits and sell them on Etsy, and I've never disclosed that to my employer because I'm just a little ashamed.
Well, little bunny foo-foo, you've been caught now.
Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. It's an interesting report, 5 pillars of company culture. You can find out more at thelasallenetwork.com. Let's talk again soon, Tom. Thank you.
Stay safe at Lala this weekend, John. I know you'll be there.
Yeah, you'll see me in the mud. Philip Weiss joins us, president of Seyfarth at Work. Visit seyfarthatwork.com. We're talking about raises today, huh, Philip?
Yes, we are. And the risk of what employers are fearing and calling the prospect of raiseflation, which is a version of inflation where companies feel the need to increase salaries to keep pace with inflation and have set something of a precedent for themselves going forward. So that's one phenomenon we're tracking. But the other one, John, is the fact that employees are approaching bosses, approaching managers, and making demands, requests, and inquiries as to whether or not their next raise will be 8, 9, or 10% given inflation, given the cost, increased cost of staples, and companies are being caught flat-footed. Their managers just don't know what to say because they haven't experienced this in a decade and a half, if not longer.
Haven't experienced what?
The employees coming up to them with these this expectation. Are we going to get a raise that matches the prevailing inflation rate because the cost of gas, the cost of food, it's out of control. And employees, John, don't have that kind of muscle memory of an earlier recessionary or inflationary period where they had to really buckle down. So they're relying on the boss and the company to make up the difference.
Well, is that a reasonable expectation? Social Security recipients get a COLA, so why shouldn't employees just to maintain?
Yeah, well, that's the employee view, and there's some merit to it. The issue, of course, is unless a company is seeing a huge spike in profits, it may not be in a position to make a promise of an across-the-board 9 or 10% increase. Plus, there's that precedent issue. If you're not properly communicating and the next year it's 2%, you're going to get a morale backlash as well. So you've got a fine line employers have to walk down. In some cases, it's really the conversation that they're bungling. For example, a restaurant came to us for some help because managers were telling employees, look, you're lucky to be working here at all. We just opened 4 months ago. You'll be fortunate to get any raise next year. So that was not the way to handle something that the company hadn't yet decided about, but certainly shouldn't have been dismissing when employees came forward. And on the flip side, John, you've got companies that are so interested in tamping down their staff worries that they'll just blanket say, don't worry, we got this, we'll cover you, which is an implication that you can expect a very significant raise. So it's a messaging challenge as much as a financial challenge.
Well, I think during the pandemic, and really now I'm thinking backwards, say 3 years, you didn't lose your job was the new raise, or you didn't take a pay cut was the new increase, right?
That's right. I mean, you're raising such an important insight because you really have to focus on the feeling of insecurity. What is it and how do you address it? And it was different in some key ways during the pandemic. So what companies have found is rather than make a promise they can't keep or dismiss the concern, you can be strategic. A lot of our clients have found that if they can provide some short-term relief, it might be gift cards for gas money or for groceries. It might be deciding to redirect some of the available funds from a branch expansion where the company was looking to grow and give a one-time special bonus. That doesn't create a precedent, but it sends a clear signal that we're looking out for you while we can in the short term, without promising anything that can't be achieved long term.
Well, should raises be based on longevity or merit?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you get morale dings or morale costs if you don't take both of them into account to at least some extent. The reality is, if it's all merit, then you're not incentivizing people to really perform. And that's a really interesting...
No. If it's all merit, you are incentivizing people to perform.
You're right. Thank you. As a lawyer, I should be thinking about the language I use. If it's all seniority, you're not incentivizing that performance. Yeah. Thanks for catching me on that. And the flip is true. If it's all merit, if it's 100% merit, the idea of loyalty, the idea of longevity, the idea of commitment doesn't always get rewarded. So a lot of companies look at both. They don't want one to be the end-all, be-all, because in some cases, somebody might be a huge rainmaker, bringing a ton of money, but they also want to reward the people who have contributed in a very stable, consistent way. So it's a good balance.
You know, what I've seen happen is where the rainmaker, they, you know, somebody's bringing in massive amounts of money to the company, and they say, you know what we're going to do is we're going to take some of those accounts and give them to Bob because you are making too much money and we don't want to be beholden to you or overcompensate you, which is back-ass words to me, but I guess that's a particular problem of sorts. Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work. Philip, it's always a pleasure. I'll have the record strike the previous remark where we got the name of the thing wrong.
And please do. Too bad it's not hearsay. I wish it was, but I said it out loud and clear.
Are you an attorney? You said as a lawyer. Is that your trade?
Yes. That's how I started for the first decades of my career, and now we take the law and make it much more simple, much more practical. That's the focus now.
What a smart application then. SciFarthAtWork.com. SceyFarth, SciFarthAtWork.com. Thank you, Philip.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Brian Walsh is on the line, the manager of financial planning and student loan expert at SoFi, SOFI.com is the website. It seems like we are constantly talking about student loans, money people have already borrowed, monies I guess people have already borrowed, or monies they're thinking about borrowing. And then are they going to get forgiveness or an extension or forbearance? Well, there's probably some basics we would all benefit from knowing about in this arena. So here's Brian to kind of fill us in. It is a very popular topic these days, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, it really is, as everyone kind of gears up for heading back to school with everything going on in the overall economy, trying to figure out how to fund kids' education right now.
Do you have advice? I know there's a few things I want to ask you in a more coordinated thought process, but just real quick, do you think that people should be paying on their student loans now during forbearance to buy down the principal?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, they'd be better off by taking that payment and setting it aside in a savings account or a checking account. So that way they have flexibility if things do go a little bit worse in the economy. And if they don't need it, then they could always just apply it to principal before the interest kicks back in to give themselves more flexibility.
Yeah, I guess that also sort of anticipates the possibility that there would be some forgiveness and you didn't need to be paying down that principal. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, as of right now, we don't have a clear consensus, and we've been waiting for answers and definition from the Biden administration, I guess, just like everyone else. But everything we've seen has been the $10,000 discussions with potentially income caps, but we're kind of in a wait-and-see mode, just like you are.
What should parents and students know before they borrow money?
Yeah, I think it's important to really assess the return on education that you're going to get. So looking at the major, the earning potential, to really kind of limit the amount of student loans you're taking out as much as possible compared to the income you're going to have to repay those. So taking full advantage of your financial aid packages, budgeting, maybe choosing schools a little bit differently, with really the goal of how do we minimize the amount that we're actually borrowing to complete an education.
Do you think that people should decide not to go to some schools they can get into because they can't afford it?
I think sometimes that would be the most prudent choice, where really it's taking a step back and looking at it and say, okay, here's the major we're looking at. Here's what the earning potential would be for school A versus school B, and then looking at what the cost would be after considering financial aid. And I think students who may be considering a lucrative career path are going to have a lot more flexibility to take on more of a student loan burden as opposed to someone who's going to major in something that doesn't have that earning power. They probably shouldn't do that.
Well, I have to tell you, this is editorial, but I just don't know how some schools that are very expensive, say private schools that have some sort of social major, right? You're going to go into social services, and they know full well what that's going to pay, and they know full well what the kid is paying to get that degree. I think that's unconscionable on the school's part, and it's foolish on the student's part.
Yeah, and I think the great news is, at least over the last few years, more so than any point in my career, families have been thinking about that more. So they've taken that burden on themselves to really make those decisions, since it doesn't really apply to the school, or it doesn't really apply when you're looking at student loans like you would assume that it would. So more and more families are taking that perspective, which is great news for the future.
It doesn't apply, meaning that the people loaning you the money don't care what your major is. They're not anticipating, like you should be, what is your ability to pay this loan back? Should parents sign for the loans? What kind of loans should families get?
Yeah, I think for parents, we urge caution when it comes to taking out parents' student loans, so where they would be the primary person responsible for paying that back, unless they go through and say, hey, my retirement can handle making these payments, because there's no student loan equivalent for your own retirement if it kind of sets you back. When it comes to co-signing student loans, really it's just making sure that if push came to shove, could you take on those payments if your son or daughter couldn't? And really understanding that, because quite frankly, most students aren't going to be able to get a private student loan without a co-signer. So it is important to consider what your backup plan would be if you had to take on those payments 5-10 years down the road.
Should you get a private loan, or should that be your last recourse?
Yeah, typically we encourage people to take full advantage of federal student loans, whether it be subsidized or unsubsidized. And that amount varies depending on your year in school. And then once they kind of max out those federal student loans, that's typically where private student loans would come into play to really kind of cap off the difference.
Is there anything different right now because of COVID-19 in terms of terms of loans, available monies? I know we're in forbearance, but anything else at play?
No, the biggest thing we're seeing right now is, for the last couple of years, we've seen, I guess, a greater propensity to stay local and more students exploring two-year schools and then transferring to four-year schools. So if that trend continues, that could be really promising in keeping the overall student loan burden lower for a similar type of education.
Brian, when does this start? When you're a junior in high school? Is that when parents start to sort of imagine how they're going to afford this?
You know, ideally, parents start as soon as possible. For context, I have a 3- and 5-year-old, and we started setting aside money for their college savings because we're fortunate to be able to do so. But if you're not talking about just saving, then you should really be thinking about this probably sophomore, junior year as you start evaluating colleges, getting everything ready to fill out the FAFSA to qualify for financial aid. That would be when that process would really kick into high gear.
What about the what is the Illinois program called where you set aside money for college when the kids are born? The Illinois's got a program. Every state has a program. What's that called again?
Yeah, so Illinois has the Bright Start and the Bright Directions. Ironically, I was born and raised in Illinois, so that's actually the 5-foot-9 plan I use for my children. Not endorsing it, but a really easy-to-use plan with pretty low expenses from a fund perspective.
Well, and that's what I've heard, that Illinois is actually a pretty good plan. It's pretty easy to use, and that is a good way to save money for college. That should be what you do, right?
Exactly. And Illinois, for their Bright Directions plan, they have a credit card you could use to get your rewards points going to your 529 plan. They have an easy gifting program for friends and family come holiday time. Hopefully your listeners have better success getting family to contribute to a 529 instead of random gifts than I did. But there's all sorts of great options with that program.
That's an interesting point. So set up the 529 and then tell grandma and grandpa, you don't need to give them a gift card. Put $100 into their program. Here's the account, right?
Exactly.
Brian Walsh is a manager of financial planning. He's a student loan expert. Find out more at SOFI.com. Really helpful today, Brian. We'll be in touch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the Wind Trust Business Lunch on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wind Trust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Two of Chicago's big three academic medical centers are among the top 20 hospitals in the country, according to U.S. News and World Report's Best Hospital Rankings. Northwestern Memorial Hospital ranks 9th. Rush University Medical Center ranks 20th. University of Chicago Medical Center did not rank in the top 20 nationally, but is highly ranked in 10 specialties. Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota is ranked as the best hospital in the country. Eli's Cheesecake is moving forward with its first bakery expansion in 30 years. The company is breaking ground this week, according to Cranes. Eli's is adding 42,000 square feet to its facility on the northwest side. That site at 6701 West Forest Preserve Drive already includes 62,000 square feet. The expansion is expected to be completed in about a year. It'll include additional production and warehousing space. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And the business of food, and Steve Alexander.
And we're happy to be sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. The saying, there is no such thing as a free lunch, goes back about 150 years or so, and the origin is a little murky, but Chicago saloons seem to have had a part in it by giving free lunches to customers, as long as they paid for drinks. Well, here comes the Obama Presidential Center offering free lunches to Chicago children, and there's no catch. Well, except that the OPC won't be open for a few more years.
Yes, but we're not waiting until the center is open in 2025 to have an impact, a positive impact.
That's Michael Stroutmanis with the Obama Foundation.
There was a very successful program in Boston giving young people healthy, culturally relevant free meals. And we thought, man, what if we could start a pilot in the city and let's see if we can deliver 100,000 meals this summer.
The effort is called the Local Lunchbox Chicago Pilot Program.
We're working with community-based organizations and connecting them with local chefs. And these chefs are amazing. By the way, they're a Black woman who has her own catering business and a Latino couple who have their own meals like barbecue rubbed chicken with green beans and basmati rice with some stew. I've tasted the food. The kids have loved it.
The YMCA, the Gary Comer Youth Center, and After School Matters are among the organizations involved in this program this summer, and there's a goal to make it year-round because
there's so many things that we need our young people to learn and that we want for them and from them. We want them to be well-educated. We want them to find purpose in life. We want them to stay out of trouble. But if you can't get a good, healthy meal, everything else is more difficult.
I suppose, Michael, one could ask if this is just a taste of what the Obama Presidential Center is going to be offering the city.
Now, see, this is why I listen to WGN. Yes, I love it. This is indeed a taste. You know, it's the city of big shoulders, right? We roll up our sleeves and we get things done. And that's what I've seen this summer, and that's what people are going to experience when the Obama Center is open in 2025. Mark your calendars.
You can find out more at locallunchbox.org/shy. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Tim Gellengarten is the owner of Transit Tees. TransitTees.com is the website. They've got storefront operations at Wicker Park and Andersonville. Welcome back to the show, Tim. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm great. Yeah. Ooh.
You are the Chicago store for Chicago stuff. What do you guys sell at Transit Tees?
So we sell items that are inspired by the CTA, like mass transit, bicycles, also anything Chicago. So I love this city, and we have themes that are all based on, say, the Chicago flag that's distressed or elements from the flag. So all things Chicago.
What's the hot seller? What's a popular item in your stores?
So right now, we just launched a whole merchandise line based on the Chicago Handshake, which is a drink combination that's based on a shot of Malort, which if you've tried it, you'll remember. Yeah. And the other element is Old Style beer. So we've partnered with Malort and Old Style to create a line of merchandise that's T-shirts, beer cozies, shot glass, of course, because that's part of the combination, a beer can glass, pint glasses, and bar keys. For the super enthusiasts, we also have a 3-foot by 5-foot flag with this emblem that our art team came up with. So we work with a graphic designer named Kyle Hollings, and he created this emblem. It's sort of a mashup of Malort shot with old style beer, and that's now created this iconic Chicago Handshake logo.
I can't make up my mind, so can you answer this for me? Do Chicagoans like Malort or not?
It's like a punishment or a prize kind of situation, yeah. And I've actually heard a few people mention they love the taste of Malort, so I'm trying to figure out what that taste is, like what creates that.
Those people are liars. But it is kind of it's almost a rite of passage for Chicagoans. Yeah. And I don't know if other cities have a similar relationship with a food or a beverage like we do that ridiculous drink.
Yeah, and it's kind of a fun thing to challenge your friends when they come visit. new people from the city, you know, buy them a Chicago Handshake. Sounds super friendly, right? So we've created this card game in last year in the fall. It was called the Chicago Handshake Drinking Card Game. It has Chicago trivia, nostalgia, facts in it, and you play this game based on Chicago, and at the end, whoever has missed the most questions has to drink the Chicago Handshake combination. And from that, it spurred these other products as well as an event this year. So this year, we are presenting an event. It is called the Chicago Handshake Challenge. So we kind of worked together with 15 local bars, and we created this actual physical passport. And what you do is you go into any one of the 15 bars, you order your Chicago Handshake, and you get this passport and your first stamp. So you get a stamp in the square. It looks like a passport with different destinations.
Yeah.
And what you want to do is collect all 15, and it kicks off on this Friday, the 29th, and it will go for 2 months. It culminates in September 22nd at the Chicago, so it's called the Chicago Handshake Challenge Party. That'll be at Emporium in Logan Square, and we're expecting between 350 and 500 people. Hopefully they've filled out their passports, and if they do, they receive a limited edition challenge coin. So it's a Chicago Handshake coin that we minted, and it has embedded enamel in it. It's really fun collector edition. They're all numbered also. And then there's merch, and we'll have Vienna Beef there with Chicago-style hot dogs, Smoke Daddy, which is another great Chicago restaurant, as well as the Tamale Guy.
Smoke Daddy's so we'll have good.
It's going to be a great party.
Tim Gillengarten is the owner of Transit Tees. Sign up, find out more, buy that stuff. Wicker Park, Andersonville, online, transittees.com. Okay, Tim, clever idea. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Stay well.